From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Good morning. Welcome to the Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Phil Connon is with us. Phil Connon is from Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. How you doing, Phil?
Yes, good morning, Phil.
First thing I better say right off the top is to remind everybody there's going to be a webinar with Eve Engler, featuring Eve Engler, and it's title, Defend Our Democratic Rights to Oppose Genocide in Gaza. A really good title, by the way. And this webinar is, you can find it at tinyur.com, T-I-N-Y-U-R.com. And you register, it's a Zoom, all these new words, a Zoom webinar. Sounds very cool. You know, a certain alienation in it. It's kind of like these people who testify in court from their prison cells or man on the street. But it's starting to get a little strange, actually. of course, the goal is to see that the charges against Eve Engler are dropped. Eve Engler ran into this phenomena of suppression of free speech by people who basically use what we call lawfare, where they say that they feel threatened or that there's somebody said something somewhere. In this case, I think a supporter of Israel had been putting some very violent and ugly tweets up, and Engler had responded or tweeted back. So he was guilty of tweet return or tweet repeat or whatever. So then they went after him, and I think there's a trial date. My guess is these things, they always go on much too long. The case ought to be thrown out. Probably will be, it'd be my guess. Anyway, we're all back to saying this is going to be on April 22nd. That's Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eve Engler, April 22nd, Tuesday, 7 p.m. And you go to Tinyur. TINYUR.com, and it's a webinar, and you register via Zoom, and it's being sponsored by the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, and you can find that, I'm sure, more readily than I can. I mentioned Phil is here, and we just noticed Amy Goodman on her show was giving a lot of attention to the passing of the Pope. If you hadn't heard, I guess he died sometime this a.m.
Yeah, this morning.
Time.
Yes, yes.
And it's very interesting about the passing of the Pope because it becomes, each time it has to, of course, happen, and it immediately turns into a kind of anxious time of, oh, well, okay, so who's going to get the job? And for me, I got into this with the, and to my mind, I mean, it all goes back to John the 23rd. That was his period as Pope was really shook the world up. He was a remarkable individual, and he's quite genuine, came from poor stock. Phil is here. He's a recovering Catholic, so he can tell us about this. But John the 23rd actually brought so many fresh ideas, but he was challenging to the empire, such as it is, run by out of London and Paris and New York, Washington. And so the people and the Catholic population around the world wanted another one like that. They loved John the 23rd. So we're several popes from there, Phil. And Are you following, or do you have any sense of where the church is going with this leadership?
Well, yes, I do. I follow it very closely. I want to say that it was a long time since I remember having enthusiasm for any pope, but I acquired an enthusiasm for this gentleman, not at first, but he grew in the job, and he had certain principles that he really wanted to put forward. He impressed me that the first week he was pope, he chose as his very first action to visit a Sicilian island called Lampedusa, which is actually in the middle of the Mediterranean and closer to Africa than it is to the rest of Sicily. And that is because the bishop there had been defying the Italian government and insisting that these many poor souls who are floating around on the open seas in these rickety boats be given succor and be given asylum and stuff like that. There had been a wonderful confrontation between the fisher people from that island when they were told by the Italian Coast Guard, you're not to help these people. And they said, I remember one guy getting on and says, you know, we follow the law of the sea, and my family's been doing this for 500 years. And when we see people in distress at sea, we don't ask questions about their politics. We just pick them up and bring them to safety, right? And the bishop there supported that, very much angering the Italian state. So the pope went out of the way to visit that place, to embrace that bishop, and made him a cardinal almost within a month, right? And that was a message right away to everybody in Europe who says, we will deal with refugees by drowning them. And he's been very consistent on that message in the years he's been the pope. And it was a wonderful thing about him.
Well, there's continuity there, isn't
right,
it?
Because there certainly
is. His last significant meeting, to his shame or misery, is that he met J.D. Vance.
Right.
But his message to J.D. Vance, I understand, was, where is your compassion? Where is your empathy? Yeah. Because, and the issue was immigrants and people without papers, et cetera, who find themselves in stressful situations. You'd think the first thing it would call for, whatever the law, is empathy toward them. That's what he was telling Vance. By the way, do you know anything about that Vance encounter?
That was
the last story.
It was very brief. Vance basically never got very far away from his limousine. They specified in the articles that he was on Vatican territory for less than 20 minutes. He met the Pope by the back door of the Vatican, hardly a real welcome, right? Yeah. And he's...
What's the title of Vance's book? A Hillbilly something.
Hillbilly,
right?
Yeah. I don't know. It's a hillbilly elegy or something. I don't know.
And now he doesn't want to be called a hillbilly.
Right, yeah. Well, that's fine. We won't call him a hillbilly. We'll call him, a powerful American politician who's messing with a lot of people's
and
lives.
And he wears eyeliner. Did you get that one?
Yeah, of course.
This has become the poor Vance.
Right.
Continue with the point. There he is going in the back door to see the Pope.
Right.
What was that? Was it, am I right, that the Pope wanted to talk specifically about the treatment of so-called illegals in the United States?
Yes. The news story that reported that said that is what they just talked about. And then Vance said something very interesting afterwards. He's a convert to Roman Catholicism. And he says, well, I'm still a baby Catholic. I'm still learning this stuff. And I'm going, yeah, they didn't teach you this when they told you to
empathy?
human empathy?
How long have you been a Christian?
And by the way, one thing about the Pope is that he wasn't like one of these politicians that says, do this because I told you to do it. He would show you stories in the gospel about why you should do this, right? And he loved pointing out that the story of Jesus includes the fact that as an infant, his family fled from Palestine into Egypt with King Herod looking to kill, because King Herod was going to kill all of the babies, without distinction, right? The male babies, right?
Yes.
And then his family was a refugee. And Francis says, we follow the leadership of Jesus Christ, who was himself a helpless infant who was a refugee. Yeah. I mean,
he told Vance that?
Yeah, he did tell the Vance. but by the way, I mean, that's always part of Catholic teaching. But it's never been emphasized the way this guy emphasized it, So, I mean,
that's really, we better check out what Vance is saying today. Probably some people are going to blame him anyway for this the Pope was on a kind of a marginal situation.
Oh, yeah. Well,
he has to see Vance.
There's even a conspiracy theory, I'm sure, will pop up about Vance poison him or something.
I assume the conversation ended with him turning the Pope saying to some aide, give me a break. it is a poignant moment, and that is very vital that we're sort of looking at it through that lens, because we do have this thing going on with an American citizen having been illegally removed from the United States, taken to El Salvador, and here's the guy who, a chest-beating, powerful president, says he can't get the man back because the dinky president of this little dictatorship that America supports, because it's, somebody says, a penal colony for the U.S., he doesn't have any power over the Salvadorian president. And therefore, he can't get the guy back. There's some elements here I want to make sure we talk about. It's going to be interesting to see whether Trump can actually double down on this really ugly approach he's taking to people who are, he declares, are illegals. They're not, actually, and for whom he provides no protections, which is his job as president of the United States. He's to protect their rights. You can remove somebody, but they also, you can't move them without demonstrating habeas corpus, bringing them in front of a magistrate, correctly identifying who they are and what is it you're claiming about them, and then they make response. By the way, that's inherited from the English tradition. I mean, the Americans didn't invent this, but the whole idea of the protection of the rights of accused people, but Trump wants to be, of course, running a show, and it is a show of people in large cargo planes with people with soldiers with masks pointing guns at them, and their feet bound, their hands behind their backs, pink costumes, shaved heads, bending. This is, you notice the perp walk aspect? Yeah. You're in a police state when everything has to be a perp walk, where you have to see the guy bent over and being forced along. He didn't do anything. He's innocent. And how do I know that? Because nobody put him in front of a magistrate to show he's not innocent. They do the act of, oh, he's obviously guilty of something. Look, his head has been shaved. He's wearing a pink costume, and we've got him bent over like a dog, and now we're going to kick him. And the people will say, hooray, thumbs down, kill him. That's a perp walk. It's
right,
a show.
Yeah.
So they've ripped up their constitution, and then you have this play-like president who says, oh, well, I've met with the president of Salvador, and he says he's going to keep the guy because he was, I think this one individual was born in Salvador.
He's a Salvadorian citizen. He had legal permanent status in the United States. He's not accused of any offense of any kind. And so you've seen this reaction that the senator from Maryland and other elected officials from Maryland have gone to El Salvador to try to rescue him. So far, without success, by the way. I mean,
some success.
He's out of the prison, but he's
they
not
got
out of
him
here.
Out of. Yeah. He said he was in. They had him in solitary confinement in an ugly Salvadoran prison. It's designed to be ugly, by the way. I'm not making this up for the fun of it. It's supposed to, because it's all is injustice done, but injustice must be seen to be done.
A great American principle.
A great, sure, goes all the way back. Yeah. And so he was, by the way, I would say to him, you're probably lucky you were in solitary confinement because there's other games they play. Actually, we've actually had American judges, I think Canadian judges have occasionally done it too, mock prisoners by saying, well, I hope he ends up, you know, with a tough individual who's going to take advantage of him. They actually talk like that. the language of our what they call jurisprudence is it always just slipping into revenge territory. It's all about revenge. Justice has nothing to do with revenge, but in fact, that's we all know on a street level, it's about revenge. We're going to get him. It's like Polev now is one of the candidates.
Oh, he's a revenger.
He's going to execute somebody.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
There is a cheering section. He knows there's about a 20% portion of the population wants to kill somebody, and they get delight out of it because it's all vicarious and not ever. There never been a present for an execution. I knew a journalist who attended the last hanging at the Dawn. He was a very reactionary individual, nasty, conservative, unfriendly, etc. But I can't explain how I happen to know him. But anyway, the two of us are talking. He said, one thing I agree with you about, to me, I don't believe capital punishment. I had to witness the one at the Dawn. He says, I don't want to ever do that again. He has nightmares.
Yeah, for sure. So you know, Phil, I was just wondering, that there is something.
We're talking about the Pope here, if you want to know. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT, 9.5 FM, according to Pedro.
But on this subject of offshoring, if that's a verb, your prisoners, you know, we talk a lot about the great crimes the Germans committed and stuff like that during World War II, but they offshored the death camps. The death camps weren't in Germany. They were in Poland and I think Belarus, but mostly in Poland, right? And it's sort of like...
They executed plenty of people in Germany.
No, of course they did, but those particular camps... And now
Talman, I think, was executed in Germany.
Right, and then you look
His
at...
His head was chopped.
But he was tried. I'm talking about the people who, you know, and he was tried, of course, by
I forgot about his trial. Right. Pardon me.
He was brought before magistrate who duly did his duty and ordered.
Who was wearing a swastika on his arm?
Of course, and ordered this. So I find you guilty, and we order you executed. But those massive death camps they set up were usually outside of Germany proper, and I'm wondering. Is Trump thinking that El Salvador might be the place, right? Because he has problems with the Cubans in Guantanamo because the Cubans don't want him there. And they still imprison people in Guantanamo too, which is something we
should there.
Remember. They're still there. They've been there for 24 years now.
And that was Obama. That was Bush. Yeah. By the way, let us all remember, if you're interested in liberals, Obama came into office and he said, they said the first 100 days. What are you going to do? And he said, "I'm going to close Guantanamo."
Yeah, we're still waiting.
Let me
for the
see. I'm looking at my watch. It's been how many years? 12?
Yeah,
I don't know. Almost 12 years.
Used that trick where they stop the clock. Right. That's an American tradition. If you watch football, you know they can stop the clock and turn 2 minutes into an hour. Right. So we're still waiting for Obama's 100 days. They're not up yet. See, so
yes. Well, actually, it's very little happened. So the. It's a fact that Bush and Cheney practiced extraterritorial incarceration and arrest and torture. By the way, you talked about offloading, offshore stuff. They were torturing people in Romania. They were torturing them in Poland. These were all newfound loyal friends to the American Empire. And they loved the idea that black ops could be carried out in their country. And that they knew they'd be rewarded. They were. I mean, a lot of people got paid off. There's a lot of money to be made in black ops because nobody can keep real close tabs on the money because the money always will lead you to the culprit. So money got dispersed and people got tortured. And Cheney ends up endorsing whatever her name was.
Harris.
Pardon me?
Kamala Harris.
Ah, Kamala. Cheney endorsed Kamala. And said... Yeah, Camelot. It's just a small circle of really unpleasant people, actually. So, anyway, back to this matter of how this policy is kicking in, of where Trump, in order to hang on to his base and to show what a great American he is, he has to round up people who don't look like Americans to him. So it's a white supremacist idea. That, you know, square-jawed, blonde people will be holding other people by the back, by the collar, forcing them down. And they will be Latino and Black. And on the show last week, I spoke about it, and that is there is a phenomena. I would urge you all to look it up. It's called La Raza. And that is the Latino Americans, but particularly Mexican Americans, who always received racial treatment. And they are, La Raza actually means the people. But the U.S. never has been comfortable with its Mexican American citizens, because they're older Americans than the Americans are. And so he's playing with fire, because when all you have to do is turn on the TV or and watch, and you say, whoa, there's a guy with my name, and the way he's treating this, being treated, and you know immediately that could be you. If his name was Brown or Jones Smith, you say, no. Well, for one, it is not going to happen. It has to be an alien person. And so they're playing the racial system. But the racial system is loaded with dynamite. And particularly in the American Southwest, this is big trouble. And I know that because my own experience from going back to Kern County and all that. And people don't know this about California. They think Californians are sleeping on a beach. And actually, the San Joaquin Valley is where most of the Californians are, and they're working their butts off. And most of them are actually Spanish or Hispanic or Mexican-American. That's who's doing the work. And they're not being compensated, but they're there. And you starve to death if they stop working. So Trump doesn't know that. He thinks he's talking about Malibu. That's on the other side of the mountain. The labor up and down that valley is, and I can tell that, you take a town like Bakersfield, which is considered kind of little Oklahoma, or used to be. It's the home of Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, who's, you know, came from cotton picking and potato picking people long since. But actually, that city now is pretty much standing against Trump. And that's it would have been a Trump area. But when you start putting your hands into their economy and their life and saying, oh, I'm going to go at the Highway 99 and I'm going to set up a roadblock and pick up everybody with a Mexican name, you are picking a fight with the whole San Joaquin. So this is ugly to watch unfold. It's hard to believe we're still talking about the Pope. Lastly, Phil, do you this Pope was an Argentine, first one from South America. They seem to be into the first business the way American liberals are. They have to have a first for something. So the first Argentine. Are they going to go for another first? Or are you hearing anything through the grapevine as to likely to be up?
I don't know who the grapevine. You know, they cite sources that, of course, that they never admit, and I don't think the grapevine knows any more than any rest of us do. But I will say this: that because the Pope appoints the people who elect his successor, there's been this ongoing tradition of, you know, one reactionary after another, because the reactionary, first thing he does is he fills up the College of Cardinals with people who think like he does, right? This Pope, however, has flipped the script on that one, because he's filled up the College of Cardinals with people who think like him, which mean people who believe in the social gospel, right? I would say I don't think that in my lifetime there'll be a papal election with less influence being exercised by the Americans, the British, and the French, and the Italians. So that's going to be very interesting to see what comes out.
There was a time when you got the impression the Americans were picking the Pope.
Absolutely.
We had the first German Pope.
Right. I think they
wasn't picked... He was the first German, right?
Well, the first and no, they probably were about 1,000 years ago. But I mean, the first Polish pope was definitely the first Polish pope, and that was the American
that
choice.
That was miserable.
And that followed on the death of a very popular and very healthy pope who had been in office for 30 days, and who died.
I thought it was 30 hours.
No, it was 30 days. They gave him a genuine.
He said he was going to be the new John 23.
He did say that, and they believed him, and they said, "Okay, well, you're not going to get the chance, right?"
We are 2025, and people, and issues of how popes come and go.
Right, but by the way,
are still very much kind of medieval.
Most people, especially from northern Italy, where that guy came from, and also where Francis's parents came from, believe that guy was murdered. I mean, you talk about the Pope who was murdered. I mean, people know who you mean and stuff like that. It's just that, of course, there was no investigation into his death. I think at this point now you're kind of in a situation where anything can happen in a papal election. So I have no particular candidate or no particular knowledge.
Do they have fist fights? throw things at each other?
They certainly did in the Middle Ages. Yeah, they had all kinds of dirty tricks to get their way. But
and occasionally the wives would interfere.
But I do want to say that if you ask me who my favorite is, I don't know his name, but he's the Bishop of Nazareth, I think, and he's a cardinal, and that would really
he
be
has sick. A shot.
Well, I have
would
no
that I- be wild if I have chose no idea, a guy that, from Nazareth?
That would be very.
Oh my gosh!
That would really be something.
But I'm not trying. You know, we're not supposed to back any candidates, but I would
right.
just say
we're observers. You know, we just.
I would urge our brothers there, whom we love so much, right. please. Take a good look at the guy from Nazareth.
There is one inside.
How can you lose if you say I'm from Nazareth?
Right. There is one inside baseball's aspect to all of this, though, which is that this pope was a Jesuit, and there's many, many, many Catholics don't like Jesuits, and you can be sure that there'll be a lot of cardinals in there saying, well, you know, whoever we elect, let's not elect a Jesuit. But interestingly, there's a Canadian Jesuit who was very close to this guy, who was one of the electors. So it'd be interesting.
Wow.
Somebody from Toronto, actually, then somebody a lot of people here know. So we'll see what happens.
Now it's like, I hate to make a vulgar analogy, but it's kind of like the Derby, you know, and you say, oh, wow, a horse called Nazareth? I'm for that. And it affects betting, you know.
Well, anybody who
it's okay to talk about betting, by the way. Right, I was reading Pascal, as you know, I spent a lot of time with Pascal, and his whole thing was about, you wager with your soul, and if you wager on the chance of heaven, as opposed to if it not, the guy who says I'll take a chance, the odds are with him. Which is very strange. I mean, people spend a lot of time talking about Pascal and his bet. Trump would really be interested in Pascal.
Yeah, well,
everything is betting.
That's if Trump knows how to read.
By the way, don't bet on Trump.
Right.
It's not looking, the odds are looking long. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to play something by Berlioz. What is this, Phil?
This is the Marseillaise as arranged by Berlioz, and he wanted people to get up and march for liberty and freedom and against the monarchy. So there you go.
We're going to play this, and then we're going to be talking about the French and the Americans and the Logan Act and the Alien Sedition Act. And later we're going to talk about why Canada has to change its attitude towards China if it wants to survive. Here's Berlioz. Oh,
traîtres, de voix conjurées. Pour qui ces ignobles entraves, ces fers dès longtemps préparés, ces fers dès longtemps préparés. Français, pour nous, à quel outrage, quel transport il doit exciter. C'est nous qu'on ose méditer de rendre à l'antique esclavage.
Here we are, we're back, and that was Berlioz, seems to be putting his shoulder into support for the French Revolution. Am I right?
Absolutely. There was something happened...
Am I right? That's a new phrase.
Something happened in 1830. The French masses said, hey, wait a minute, what happened to our revolution? And they started up again. And they keep doing that. Right. They were marching around Paris singing this thing, and Berlioz says, I've got a skill where I can really make that thing sound... hair raising, and he did, you know.
Yeah, it was good for him.
Yeah,
it was. What was it? It was 1830
exactly. There was something. They were successors to the. They were monarchists without being monarchists who were running France at the time, right? So they said we have to do a second cleansing here. We're not finished.
They keep fighting each other the way we do,
and
the way the Americans do. I wanted to play that because the Trump administration is using it has reintroduced the idea of the Alien and Sedition Act. By the way, he's being beaten up in court pretty much over this, but. To understand, people, you have to appreciate that the American Revolution, as it is called, the War of Independence, was financed by the French. As a matter of fact, the great victory at Yorktown, the commanding officers, the ones who really had the most training and were in charge of the artillery, if I can call it that, cannons, were French. Not that that's terribly pertinent to the point, but here's the matter. The leaders of the American Revolution were quite at odds with each other. Once they had won the recognition as a country, the question was, okay, do we rule it in the name of who or whom? And the right wing captured power pretty much. And the worst of the SOBs that took over was Hamilton, who never got elected anything, by the way. He was kind of a, I don't want to call him a Roy Cohn, but he was, Cohn well, stayed a little bit more in the background, but he was an operator.
That's an interesting comparison, yeah.
An operator.
Yeah.
And he had, as they say, the ear of Washington. And Washington being the only guy in the country that anybody knew the name of, in terms of ordinary Americans. So the French Revolution occurred, 89, and then it became quite radical, and it went with the notion of human equality. It used to be called the rights of man, but of course man has to be interpreted now, obviously it includes, means humankind, that we're born equal. And we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Well, the French really thought that was a great idea. The Americans thought they were kidding. The French took it seriously. And so the French Revolution ended with the, I shouldn't say ended, but it had a big chapter with the king who was conspiring with foreign powers to restore his monarchy. And that's not disputed. He was asking them to come and overthrow the revolution, and he was executed. Well, Hamilton, Washington, and that crowd did not like this at all. And so exercising their power, they decided to turn on what had been their allies, the French, and they introduced Alien and Sedition Acts to repress freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and, of course, to charge foreigners. And they drove them out. They were left by the thousands. They were forced out of the country. These were French sympathizers or French who had made their, had come to America and were very influential. They, the American, the U.S., the new country of the United States, the population was very pro-revolution because they felt in their own country that they had not realized what they thought they were going to get with under Washington. And so they went through a period of repression. At, for example, the nephew of Benjamin Franklin had a paper. He hated Hamilton and he hated the American elite, upper class. And so they took his press away from him and put him in jail. So Trump is returning to the counter-revolution because, in fact, what Alien Sedition Acts was a counter-revolution. And it comes up now. You mentioned the congressman from Maryland who went to Salvador. They're talking about using the Logan Act on him. The Logan Act was part of the counter-revolution. Just as the Jay Treaty was part of the counter-revolution because it was a shifting from alliance with the French, which was had become a revolutionary alliance, to a reactionary one. And just to tell you, it's absurd. The Logan Act makes no sense. They've tried to prosecute people under it. They've had two or three in American history. It doesn't ever work because, in fact, they say American citizen who meets or negotiates with a foreign government. Logan was not negotiating with a foreign government. Logan was an American pacifist who did not want to see a war with France. So when the Hamilton and the other liars who were running the White House said, the French are double-crossing us, and the French are this and the French are that, Logan said he didn't believe it, and so he took it upon himself to get the facts. Basically, what he was doing was journalism. He went to them, to any leader he could speak to, and said, I don't understand why we can't have an agreement. And they said, we don't understand either. It's your friend Hamilton who's causing this problem. And so Logan was reporting what he was told. And they were manufacturing a break with France to cause them to declare war. If you can look it up. It's called the Quasi-War. They went through a period where they wanted to go to war with France. Get a load of this, Phil. They were going to name Alexander Hamilton. He was named by John Adams to be the head of the American Army, commander of the American Army. And he was going to do this was as a, what do you call it, a subaltern or to George Washington. George Washington allowed his name. He said, okay, nominally, I'll be the guy so that the American people will get behind it because, again, they only knew Washington anyhow, or put it another way, they only trusted him. So you know, to help Hamilton get to be the head of the army, they had Washington say, I'll be the overall guy, but he will be the head of the army. It was going to be a coup. I mean, this is counter-revolution, really serious counter-revolution. And Logan caused a problem for them because he came back and he said, I saw the French. They told me there's no problem. Now, they said, you were negotiating. No, he didn't negotiate. How could he? The absurdity is that any citizen going to talk to a foreign power, whatever he might claim, does not represent the American government. So he can't be negotiating. All he's doing is talking. So he can report his talk, but the government would say, obviously, we're the government. So him talking doesn't mean anything. So they tried to charge him. It didn't work. People should know that our good friend, I call him good friend, he was certainly close to the Taylor Report, Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States. He went to Iran after the Islamic Revolution took place, and Jimmy Carter threatened him with the Logan Act.
Wow. I did not know that.
A very serious moment.
Yeah.
Because they said, well, when he comes back, we haven't made up our mind, but he could be prosecuted under the Logan Act. Well, Ramsey was, of course, a rather accomplished lawyer, and he was certainly a very accomplished former attorney general. And his position was, go ahead and charge me. Let's see what happens. He would have been the new Logan. Because what could he say? I didn't represent you. I was just talking to them. And this is what they told me. I want the American people to know that's what they said. And we say this on the Taylor Report quite often. What they're actually saying is we want total control over speech and interaction of people and freedom of movement of people. We want control over that. And in other words, rip up the Bill of Rights and rip up the Constitution in the name of what? Security. It's always security. We're making you safe. That's why we shot those guys. And that's why we're putting you in prison, so you'll be nice and safe. So that was what the Logan Act was intended to do. It was an attempt at a counter-revolution. They were defeated because eventually thanks to freedom of speech, thanks to the fact that people didn't like the Alien and Sedition Act because it permitted the government to interfere in everybody's affairs, they pushed back. And John Adams went out and Thomas Jefferson came in. And they patched together their bad feelings. They remain damaged. Relations between states are always complicated anyway. But so there is that. That's why we played that's the Marseillaise.
That's right? The Marseillaise.
With Berlioz.
Berlioz's version of the Marseillaise.
Yeah. And, I thought he was about to do it again. So, at any rate, I guess we've covered that. I think it's very important to people to know their history. Incidentally, the War of 1812 was another battle over the same issue where the British thought that they would take one more run at removing this irritant called the United States.
By the way, Phil, I think it's worthy to mention that the election of 1800, when Jefferson defeated Adams, was accompanied by the same kind of personal invective and insulting language and wild accusations about people's personal lives.
It was sordid.
Yes. S-O-R-D-I-D. Sordid is the word. Yes, it was.
Sordid.
Yeah.
And, well, that's when America became aware that Thomas Jefferson had a wife who was a slave.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons that people found this. Of course, because they use these terms, slave, what they didn't know about her was that she was the half-sister of his first wife, and she very much resembled her. That's because his father-in-law had, long story. It's important to get to revisit those matters, but just to move it quickly, the War of 1812, strangely enough, the slogan under which the Americans fought the war was free trade and free sailors. Because the two problems they had was the British was restricting their trade movement because they had dominance over the sea, just as America today has dominance over the sea. And you know that at the end of the day with Trump, what he's going to say is, I don't care about any of this stuff, trade, whatever you call it. You're not going to go into that port because I have warships that are going to prevent you from going into that port. And that's why we say be careful about debates about it. A struggle over free trade, it can lead directly to war. But the Americans were fighting themselves against the British in the name of free trade. And, of course, and free sailors. Was what they were referring to was the Trump tendency, and now at that time the British government's tendency to capture people at sea and make them serve in their Navy. And they were stopping American ships, taking as many sailors as they want. And this was created a lot of bad blood. A lot of people died in that. Incidentally, if you were Irish and you were on an American ship, they would come aboard the ship. If you were just a merchant sailor, they'd come aboard the ship and they say, "We want to talk to the crew members." And they'd walk along and they'd ask them their names and talk to them. If they heard an Irish accent, they grabbed them because they said, "You're British. You're under our authority. You're Irish. You belong to us." And they would take them. So this phenomenon went on. The best story, let's tell it this way. Phil, you know the story Billy Budd. I think it's been made into an opera.
It has been made. It's one of the greatest operas of the 20th century. Yeah.
So Billy Budd was one of those sailors who was aboard an American ship, merchant ship, and the British came aboard and took him and some others. And this is a Herman Melville story. And so as they put him in the rowboat with the other captors, they're taking him to the British ship. He's looking at the ship he has been taken from. He's a sweet young man. That's why he gets killed, is that he dies of being too nice. So Billy Budd is looking at the ship he's leaving, and he said, "Goodbye, old rights of man." Later, he's hanged. There's a movie, if you want the short version. This is a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Let's move to another matter here, which is the issue of trade. And we would like free trade. That's what I'm told. And we'd like these tariffs to be removed. But all of our leaders who want office are sworn enemies of the People's Republic of China. Sworn enemies. They're SOBs. They're crazy. They're mad hatters. So here's a country that doesn't want to molest you and couldn't care less who your prime minister is, being looked at, examined by the CBC, the Globe and Mail, and all our media, because they all know that ideologically, they are driven by the idea that we are the free world and we represent advanced humanity, and that China cannot be regarded as equal to us. And we must protect our sacred ideology, which is free enterprise, monopoly capitalism, and we can't have the concept of public industries, public-controlled banks, et cetera, through a social system that's devoted to the idea that it is there to serve all the people, whether they own anything or not. So this problem is, to my mind, is staring us in the face. Clearly, they say, well, we're going to trade with other countries. So that immediately they say South Korea, or they say, of course, Europe. But they don't want to say China because they cannot abandon their ideological commitment to the idea that the ultimate struggle is against this developing country that had been under 100 years of our occupation, ours. Canada was part of the British Empire, standing on the chest of China, forcing them to take opium, et cetera. And that's what the opium wars are about. You will take the opium. So here we are now where we can't abandon it. And that includes Mr. Jagmeet, and that includes, of course, Paulette, because, of course, Paulette was born with Ayn Rand between his ears. And then you have the banker, and you have the Western Empire. And so the idea of being friendly or respectful of China just is not there. I would say the Canadian Parliament has to revisit, go back, and apologize for smearing a country. It talks about, for example, the Uyghur issue. They voted unanimous. Every NDPer, everybody in the parliament condemned China's, they said, the treatment of the Uyghurs, about which they know nothing. Parliament did not send a fact-finding mission. They just read the Globe and Mail and knew what they were supposed to do. The Muslim countries of the world did send a large delegation to visit the region, Xinjiang, of China, and they found it a developing and inspiring territory in which there is a Muslim majority population. And they praised China. Now, these are Muslim countries, by the way, with whom Canada has relations. And again, maybe we need a Logan here, but no one in Parliament has been there. So they're perfectly comfortable with smearing them and running against all the evidence of the development of that country, with whom we should have a dynamic trade relationship. It's there for the taking. But there's a reason we're not going to take it. It's because our prime minister and the president of the United States are all agreed that, no, you can't do that. And I'll just bring up Norway. Norway is buying now Chinese automobiles. The cheapest one sells for less than $5,000, electric vehicles, because Norway's committed to 100% electric vehicles, and they're approaching that. And they can buy these Chinese vehicles because Norway did not put a tariff on Chinese vehicles. And, gee, the Norwegians like that. So why? I'm not saying we have to become a socialist country. That's beyond comprehension in this culture. And Jagmeet would be the first to make sure we didn't. But we could at least engage in free trade, fair trade. And when we say, oh, is there anything more evil than Trump putting 25% on our automobiles? Yeah, you put 100% on Chinese vehicles. You, the injured party, you put 100% tariff on Chinese automobiles. Hardly something that is defensible. If it's bad for the goose, I guess it's bad for the gander, isn't it? I think I've got it upside down, but so does the world. Anyway, this is, and of course, Phil, you and I both read the Globe, and we have this problem.
Oh, yes.
What is it? Every third day, right, that Spike and Chase or Chase and Camp or whatever it is find somebody who likes the Chinese. And he went to a party once, and there was a Chinese consulate there. Are they aware that's what consuls do?
Yeah, what they're aware of is they know what pleases their employers. I want to point out that the latest scandal they've uncovered is that somebody went to an event that commemorated the victory of China during World War II. China was our ally during World War II.
I heard about that.
Yeah.
We were
on the same side.
They lost more than 10 million people fighting the Japanese. And we thought that was kind of good.
Yeah.
Because we weren't having to do that. We don't have 10 million to lose at the time. Mm-hmm. There wouldn't have been any Canada. No, indeed. Should we mention Norman Bethune? I mean, he just disappeared. Periodically pops up, and then he disappears. But yes, the Chinese were our allies in fighting Japanese imperialism, and they had to fight the Japanese on their own soil. And one of the reasons there's so much ignorance in the United States and Canada is that we did not, our cities didn't burn down. Our people weren't, as in Nanking, raped, and the army was just allowed to run loose for the fun of it, just do what they wanted to do, to slaughter people. And that was a very obviously the most crucial part of the victory in the Pacific was the tying down and defeating of the Japanese army. And yet, as you pointed out, the Globe and Mail had this thing about somebody in Toronto from the Chinese-Canadian community attended a commemoration of that army. Right. Well, I wish I'd been invited.
Right. He was a senior police officer in Toronto, by the way, at the time.
Right? Yes. So, well, of course, that's doubled. Now you're talking about doubling it. That makes it twice as bad.
Right.
That he actually celebrated our common victory against the Japanese.
Yes, that's what he was celebrating.
And we have this thing of, well, why wouldn't a Chinese Canadian, for the most part, I'm not talking about every single person, but for the most part, recognize that something phenomenal has happened in their home country? And shouldn't they share that knowledge with their fellow Canadians the way an Irish Canadian celebrates some advanced legislation from his homeland, or a Swedish Canadian, a Danish Canadian? Did I mention the Danes are disappearing, of course? Trump's going to fix that. That's part of our culture, is that people bring their knowledge of their own country, except in China, in the case of China, it's not listened to here. It's the people who are authorities on China, people who've never been there, don't speak Chinese. Now, they really know. But if a Chinese Canadian dares to mention some facts about his homeland, her homeland, they need to be looked into by Snake and Chase, you know. And we need more revealing things. I actually read in the Globe that they said they have a department of disinformation. No, they don't. Please, show me the evidence. What they have is an information department. You call it disinformation. Of course, I understand everything you say is information. And if somebody disagrees, it's like you and I arguing about Guerrero or something. If you say, he hasn't got enough home runs, I call that disinformation. Well, you know, it's just absurd. All it is opinion. But this is quite serious because this trade war is clearly has starting to develop the teeth and barbs of a potential actual war. And our ruling political elite are bolted down in hostility towards China, which, by the way, is a member of the Security Council of the United Nations. So you can stop patronizing them. They're big stuff. They helped form the United Nations. And the United Nations is potentially what could save us all from disaster. So you better make up your mind, because Trump, by the way, his conduct will lead to the breaking up of the UN. You can just almost smell it. You know, it has an aroma about the way he's conducting himself, is that they're withdrawing from the environmental protection, they're withdrawing from the World Health and don't worry, they will withdraw from the UN. They're capable of that because they are ideologues of the first water. And so are we going to stay with the Security Council, the United Nations, or are we going to follow Trump? And all of our political leaders will say, I hate Trump, but I'm going to follow him. That's what they're going to do. So this is the Taylor Report, and Steve Fruitman's coming up. And thanks, Phil Conlon and Pedro.